Welcome to Acute Leukemias Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Levis, and to begin, I asked him to talk about how molecular testing for patients with AML has affected diagnosis and therapeutic decision-making.
For years, we didn't make any progress with AML. It was always one size fits all. Everybody got the same chemotherapy. But over the last 5 or 10 years, it's dawned on us through current research that, in fact, we're treating 20 different diseases. It's probably going to apply to most cancer. AML might be the earliest of these where we're really using targeted therapies to bring about cures. But now, when somebody comes in with AML, you really have to look at it as what subtype of AML this is. It's not just find out that it's not APL and move on. Now it's really start breaking this thing down because the targeted therapies really are applicable to different subtypes. They're having a big impact on these patients now. So it's all about, yes, you have a diagnosis of AML that comes across literally that day or the next day. No, just stop if you can, and wait for the molecular. You've got to wait for the molecular now. And so that's thrown us all into a whole new tizzy because the molecular doesn't come back that fast. And so you've got to make a judgment as to whether or not you've got to start treatment or I can hold off until I can get that molecular back.
When you talk about molecular markers, you know, broadly in oncology, we talk about prognostic and predictive markers. Can you overview in your mind what are the key essential prognostic and predictive markers?
So I've never been as excited as a clinician by prognostic and predictive markers. The big cooperative groups get all excited about this. Oh, you've got a 60% chance of long-term survival versus 30. Sit in the room with a patient. I don't really understand how that makes a difference to them. They're roughly 50-50 chance of having something terrible happen. So I'm not excited about prognosis. You know, great news, you've got good risk AML. I don't even know what that is. I certainly know what incurable AML is, and there are some subtypes that you need to know are probably incurable right now. But I think nowadays I'm lumping AML into, is this a TP53 mutated AML or not? That actually, I like to think of that as liquid pancreatic cancer. We just looked at our data at Hopkins. We're not curing any of these patients with TP53. And so we actually want to separate those out and not necessarily hammer them and treat them as a separate category. They're not a large category, but you have to get those out first, that 10%, and then break down the remaining 90%. Is this a FLT3? Is this an IDH mutant case? Is this an NPM1 without any other mutations? And then look at the patient. We've got a lot to choose from now. And so you're mixing and matching things. So for the private practitioner looking at a new diagnosis of AML, you still can't just regard this as one disease anymore. It's just not one size fits all.
So again, thinking about a common situation of an older patient, maybe in their 70s, not really eligible for aggressive therapy, what do you consider the essential things that need to be looked at? And maybe you could talk a little bit more about P53 in terms of how to manage a patient like that.
So P53, unfortunately, we don't know the answer other than don't try and hammer them too hard. So the typical TP53 patient is going to be older, not always, but usually is going to be older. You can pull out an intensive induction for them and probably harm them. You literally are hurting them more than you're hurting the leukemia. So with an older patient that comes in, and I've now had, this is a regular feature of my practice, I'm getting referred patients in their mid-70s that the general oncologist is saying, okay, I've got another AML. Do you got anything special for this one? Interestingly, they're being returned to the practitioner after we scope them out. Okay, there's no TP53. They've got kind of garden variety genetics. I'm recommending outpatient therapy with azacitidine and venetoclax, say. This is seemingly happening on a weekly basis in my practice. These patients are now back in the care of their oncologist, being managed as outpatients with very effective therapy. The patients have no idea how different this is than just 3 or 4 years ago.
So we actually made it through 5 minutes of discussion without me asking you about venetoclax and hypomethylating agents, but you already brought it up. And actually, you know, when you said P53, I was kind of flashing on, you know, CLL, you know, completely different disease, but, you know, now you've got a total different algorithm and novel agents there.
Interestingly, I was just reviewing a manuscript for a drug that had been tested in CLL, and it's the best thing since sliced bread, and they're trying to use it in AML. And I said, we're in a different world here. I don't think it's going to work. Although, with AML, obviously, venetoclax is a very popular new drug. That said, we just looked at our TP53 data at Hopkins, and I was just discussing it with another colleague. We're not making any progress, even with that new therapy, except actually it was quickly pointed out, wait a minute. No, we did take these patients with that treatment. They weren't in a hospital. We did put a number of them in remission. Everybody relapsed and died. But even in that horrifically bleak context, several of these patients, basically, I remember one, this guy, I said, the clock is ticking. You have about a year. He got out his boat. He had a great year. Knowing this was very different than this kind of long, strung out treatment process that we used to do. At least we can tell them, this is a terminal illness, but we're going to give you actually quality of life during this next 6 or 12 months. So the AML doctor frequently regards everything as a failure if I don't cure. But you really have to step back and say, no, some of these cases are just like a metastatic solid tumor where, no, your job is to provide duration of life and quality of life.
You know, like I said, I was going to try to get through targeted therapy first, but let's just jump right into venetoclax. This is kind of something I just started hearing about in the last few months. And, you know, at least from the point of view, as you say, in terms of palliation of extending life, this seems to be something that people ought to know about. So can you talk a little bit about what we know at this point about hypomethylating agents of venetoclax in AML, particularly older patients?
So the venetoclax, of course, was quite an effective drug in CLL, in particular these pretty nasty 17p deletions. As a single agent, it was studied in AML, and it really was no great shakes, nothing terribly impressive. Why it works when you combine it with a hypomethylating agent, maybe all targeted agents work better when you do that, but this one was perhaps the easiest. And it really did something dramatic. All of us had been used to doing these trials. We really sat up and took notice that these patients were just sort of flying into remission. And this was this same crowd that had been such a challenge before. They're 75. Their oncologists has referred them to us because they didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, 30 days later, I'm calling up that oncologist. Hey, guess what? I've got your patient. He's in remission. It's in your books now. I want you to give subcutaneous AZA. He doesn't need a central line. I don't know how long this will last, but you can come in and get treatment every 1 or 2 months. The data were just published, and the doc wanted to know that publication, so I forwarded him on. It's 145 patients. They were treated with a mix of either decitabine or azacitidine, although the lean is more toward AZA, a little less myelosuppressive. That said, you can do this in an office. You can do this at home. The patients, if they need to be admitted, it's very brief. And the data are pretty consistent. A response rate, something like 70%. We looked at ours. A response rate in a clinical trial is a tricky thing. I viewed our patients as more, well, what's practical for my patient? A complete remission. When I say complete remission, I want that patient not transfusion dependent at all. I want them having stone cold normal counts. That happened more than half the time in this older population. If you take out the TP53s, it was even higher. So again, separate the TP53s. We got some CRs in the TP53s, but separate those out. And all of a sudden, I think this is a wave sweeping the country, at least in terms of AML therapy. It really is going to become a new standard of care, certainly for this population. Actually, now people are bringing up, why not for the younger ones? This works better than chemo, we think.
You know, the other thing that's really fascinating about this, you know, in our version of the consensus conference is we asked 25 investigators, like, what do you do in your practice? And for example, if I ask you, outside a clinical trial setting, you've got a 70-year-old patient with AML, what's your standard first-line therapy?
Well, so at this point, my standard first-line therapy is AZA and venetoclax. And in fact, I was at a meeting at Baylor University, a visiting German clinician and a prominent one in the cooperative groups in Germany stood up and said the same thing. Oh, we're getting the drug off label. Insurances are paying for it because it works. They're doing the same thing.
Yeah, a very good quote, value, as they say, cost effective in a way. Actually, interesting when you think about all the morbidity that it's avoiding. What about in the patient with a targetable lesion, for example, FLT3 mutation?
Now, there's a tricky affair. If it's an older patient, I've had a FLT3 patient respond very nicely to venetoclax. At first, the rumors were the FLT3s don't respond to venetoclax, but in fact, they do. So you're really left with, okay, what are my goals here? Is this a younger patient that I'm going to try and take to a bone marrow transplant and cure? And that's how we think of FLT3. If this is a 79-year-old, in fact, I just had a 79-year-old show up with FLT3 disease. Those are a little uncommon. And I made a decision that I think was the wrong one. This was a year ago. I chose a dose-reduced 7+3+ midostaurin, and I'm thinking azacitidine would have been a better choice.
What about azacitidine FLT3 inhibitor?
Sure. That's an option too, I suppose. I'm not sure. There's a drug called gilteritinib, and it's available for relapse refractory, but yes, not so much midostaurin, but gilteritinib. I would certainly think about throwing that in with venetoclax and AZA. And by the way, the gilteritinib-venetoclax trial is already fired up and enrolling. So we already are going to have data on at least that combination.
Gilteritinib-venetoclax without a hypomethylating agent?
Correct.
Wow.
Just an initial safety study.
Wow, that sounds cool.
But obviously, toss it in with the azacitidine then.
That's really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Another possibility might be thinking about other examples in oncology. You could start out with venetoclax, azacitidine, and add in FLT3 inhibitor, gilteritinib if the patient wasn't doing well or they started to progress. The thing that's been so amazing to me as I've been hearing this story over the last few months and trying to get it out, and in the meeting you were at, you know, you all presented those data, everybody changed their practice right there.
We hope so.
They did.
I'm curious if some of these physicians are going to stop referring the 75-year-olds to us and say, I know how to do this. I have no qualms teaching them about azacitidine, and they're starting to use it.
That gets into part two. And incidentally, in that meeting, we actually did a pre and post, and they literally changed their practice that day. But
oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was amazing. But the other thing that is really fascinating about this is the issue of prevention of TLS, because, you know, this is so new.
Oh, yeah.
I know that TLS hasn't been seen, but these people have been put in the hospital. They're watched for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Should these patients go in the hospital for a couple of days to get started?
In my opinion, yes. We just had another case of tumor lysis with azacitidine. We're using it more. Actually, I think we can predict which ones. They tend to be the so-called favorable risk. Every now and then, somebody with older AML actually shows up with favorable risk, young person's AML. Those were always more responsive to chemotherapy. I'm talking like a core binding factor, AML. That'll pop. That will really lyse. My approach has always been, you know, this is usually a 76-year-old. You're just giving them this information. You got to learn about transfusions and stuff. They're busy freaking out. I usually like to admit them during the first few days. It just makes it easier on everybody. And I think it's actually medically indicated. Every now and then, someone will have some tumor lysis. That's really not the primary reason to admit, in my view.
Well, the other thing, of course, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about tumor lysis with CLL and venetoclax, and, you know, those are older people too. But one of the things I didn't realize originally when venetoclax came out and they had that package insert and all was how important renal function is. And now you're talking about older people inherently with less renal function. That makes it trickier.
We actually didn't really see a problem, though, in AML. Again, the tumor lysis is such an uncommon thing. I personally, and we've treated a lot, I've not seen a problem sending somebody off to dialysis. You know, usually before you start, again, our practice has been to admit most of these patients, so I'll hydrate them gently, and it's generally not a problem. But yeah, well, with CLL, that's always been a problem with CLL. Every time they come up with a new agent, the cells explode and the patients get into trouble.
You know, clearly CLL is different, but still, even in terms of the fact that those 145 or 150 patients, that was what happened to them. They went in the hospital, they were watched for a couple of days, they had the dose escalated. So to me, if you want to replicate that, I mean, nobody likes going in the hospital.
I don't find that's a big deal. If you tell somebody, hi, you have a life-threatening near-terminal illness, that's a shock to them. We're going to put you in the hospital for a few days. The bigger shock I would always get out of these patients is you're going to be in the hospital for 40 days. 40 days, you know. No, in the hospital for 4 days, you know, that's easy to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, particularly if you say, because we're going to watch you very carefully because this treatment destroys the cancer so fast that you get complications. That's kind of not a bad reason to want to be in the hospital.
Yeah.
Anyhow, well, let's move on now, though. And I've been fascinated by a lot of the work that you've done with FLT3 mutant disease. And I'd like to try to maybe understand better a little bit more, not just about the management of it, but maybe some of the biology of it and the difference in the TKIs, et cetera. Anyhow, so maybe you could just contrast. You have these two patients here, 62-year-old woman and 60-year-old man. Maybe you can kind of talk about them, and we'll use those two cases to kind of get into the whole issue.
Well, the 62-year-old woman is a very typical case that you're going to see. And, you know, she presents with the usual story of an AML patient. That's not going to be a surprise to any oncologist. That's how they present. You know, I'm fatigued or whatever, and somebody gets a white count, and oh my goodness, and off to the emergency room. But she's a good example of characterize things molecularly. You've got to know that she has a FLT3 mutation. Doesn't matter what kind. It's an activating mutation. The basic biology is FLT3 is one of these cytokine receptors, and the oncologists have learned about what the heck FLT3 is, but it's kind of the perfect little receptor to make an AML cell happy. There's a lot of biology behind where FLT3 normally functions, and normal FLT3 functions in early myeloid cells. It's the driver for their growth. It helps marrow recover from chemo. So the leukemia cells figured out how to turn this sucker on and keep it on constitutively. And so it's really the perfectly designed growth receptor for an AML cell. So it's pretty darn common. If somebody comes in, we can spot these patients routinely. They come in, anybody with a high white blood cell count, the oncologist has to be thinking this is FLT3, has to be thinking. And they've got to get that test back to confirm that that mutation is present within a week, because you got to start the targeted agent at that point.
Just out of curiosity, you know, from a basic pathophysiology point of view, where does FLT3 fit in compared to, say, Neupogen does in terms of growth factor stimulants?
Neupogen is a similar growth factor. If you give chemotherapy to a breast cancer patient and cause aplasia, they will get a natural elevation of GCSF, and they'll get an elevation of FLT3 ligand, which is trying to turn on FLT3. They work synergistically to recover the marrow. We kind of pump things up with more GCSF to speed the later neutrophil development along. But those early neutrophils are generated by FLT3 ligand, which is a very brief thing. It goes up and then comes back down when you recover. So that's the thing that's making early myeloid cells grow fast is FLT3 and the natural FLT3 ligand. So yes, you could actually, in fact, FLT3 ligand is an approved product in some cases. It mobilizes stem cells and things like that. It's a cytokine.
Really? That's interesting. Kind of works like GCSF.
Yeah, it really is.
So also, can you talk about the types of FLT3 mutations? She had ITD, but there's also, was it TKD?
Yeah, so two different ways. The TKDs resemble, are the same types of mutations that you'll see in a lung cancer and EGF receptor mutation. They're point mutations. The ITD is a very particular one, and it is unique to FLT3. We don't see these types of mutations in other receptor tyrosine kinases. It's this long inserted sequence that gets stuck into a regulatory region. And the mechanism, you can go into it, it's something called slippage repair, but basically it's pretty unique to FLT3. And it activates the receptor, shall we say, more strongly. This is a much more potent way of activating the receptor than just a little point mutation. So this thing, which is a growth factor for early myeloid cells, really gets revved up a couple of orders of magnitude. And so that ITD, that's the common one. That's going to be in 1 in 5 patients. The TKDs, tyrosine kinase domain mutations, these little point mutations, they are not as scary. The patients may not have a high white count. Sometimes they're driver mutations. Sometimes they're just in a little subclone. But what was key is it doesn't matter, at least in terms of the initial treatment with midostaurin, the approved targeted agent for this subset of AML patients, doesn't matter. Patients benefit regardless of the type of FLT3 activating mutation they have. The ITD is the really scary one. The TKDs have a more questionable impact. The ITD is going to get your attention. They're going to have the white count of 120,000.
So can you talk about the other findings that she had on molecular analysis?
So she had the typical molecular profile of one of these patients is they'll have a FLT3 ITD. And oftentimes the report will come back and tell you how much ITD is there. And I would tell the practitioner, disregard that. It does not impact your choice of midostaurin. And while some cooperative groups have tried to claim it should impact what you do, it really shouldn't. People are coming to the conclusion, no, everybody gets kind of the same treatment. Targeted agent with midostaurin, get them in remission and try an allo transplant. Her other molecular features, though, are interesting because she did have an NPM1 mutation. You're going to see that go along a lot with these patients. She also actually had a D835Y. Look at that. She had two different types of FLT3 mutations. And that actually is going to become important. If you have a FLT3 TKD, you will not respond to some of the FLT3 inhibitors that are out there. For example, sorafenib, which many practitioners kind of use off-label, will not work in a FLT3 TKD patient. There's another drug that's probably going to be approved in 2019 called quizartinib, absolutely does not work in a TKD patient. So unfortunately, the oncologist does need to know TKD versus ITD down the road. Initially, though, it's important just that they've got a FLT3 mutation. They need, you know, if they're newly diagnosed, they need induction chemotherapy plus midostaurin.
Why would somebody give sorafenib when midostaurin is available?
In the relapsed setting, if you're relapsed and you've got a FLT3 mutation, people have this idea, oh, well, for one thing, this is another important point that practitioners should be aware of. Midostaurin has zero role in that setting. It's completely ineffective in the relapse setting, largely because in the relapse setting, what's emerged is a truly FLT3-driven clone. Midostaurin is a pan-targeted thing. It hits a little bit of FLT3 and a bunch of other things. It's a pretty weak FLT3 inhibitor. You're going to have to move to a much stronger FLT3 inhibitor at that point, which was sorafenib, but sorafenib doesn't hit the TKD. And so that's how these patients would get resistant to sorafenib. Gilteritinib gets them both. And so gilteritinib's label is for relapse refractory.
Can you just kind of bring us up to date on what happened to this patient?
She came in with, you know, what we call really kind of garden variety FLT3 ITD disease. And she received 7+3, we recognize as a high white count, a 60-year-old patient. This is a high likelihood of being a FLT3 disease. We made sure we had the molecular back before day 8, which is when you would want to start your midostaurin. Midostaurin is really effective during that day 8 to 21 period after induction and not much else. So she got 7+3+ midostaurin, had a relatively uncomplicated remission induction, achieved remission. We did a single cycle of high-dose cytarabine with midostaurin, and by then we had set up a transplant, and she's now had a bone marrow transplant. And then the final issue that comes up, and that went quite smoothly, and I should point out, transplant has gotten far less toxic than it used to be. And so we're routinely transplanting older patients, including, and I didn't mention this, the AZA venetoclax crowd. If they're fit enough, even if they're 75, we'll transplant them. But this patient had a final decision to make. You know, this is a tyrosine kinase activation. It's just like BCR-ABL. Patients who have BCR-ABL-driven leukemias who get transplanted are often put on the BCR-ABL inhibitor after transplant as maintenance therapy. So she's actually participating in a trial in which she's randomized to get either gilteritinib, which we think is a pretty good inhibitor, or placebo. But as I pointed out to her, her long-term survival rate is actually superb right now, having gone through a transplant, been almost a year out from the transplant, having received midostaurin before the transplant, because that put her in a deeper remission. We know this. And if you're in a deeper remission before transplant, your outcome with transplant is that much better.
So this trial is kind of like gilteritinib maintenance?
Yeah. So maintenance is a big issue and probably is effective. Even midostaurin probably provides some benefit as maintenance, although only in a fraction of patients. This drug, gilteritinib, is a much better FLT3 inhibitor. Again, if you're on this trial, only about half the patients are going to get benefit, but this is going to be an important one to demonstrate that maintenance is really necessary. We're not always sure about this. And in fact, there was a recent trial in CML patients where maintenance therapy did no good whatsoever. That was a randomized trial and surprised a lot of people. So we think it's important to do the trial. She's already got a good prognosis from the treatment that she got as a standard of care, and this is kind of icing on the top.
So I know this is a placebo-controlled trial, but any sense, I don't know, maybe can you figure out who's on the drug or not?
No, that's the beauty of it. Gilteritinib causes no side effects. You could never do this study effectively with midostaurin.
Huh, wow.
Midostaurin, the pills smell really bad, and they also cause nausea.
Really?
Yeah.
I never heard that.
I have never seen a medication that smells bad, but this one does.
Wow.
They keep it in bubble wrap, in blister packs.
Really?
Open bottle of midostaurin pills.
Wow.
That would just stink up the room.
Did not know that. Yeah. Interesting. So just briefly, what happened with your 60-year-old man? So he got gilteritinib plus 7 plus 3. I guess it was on a trial.
Yeah. So this guy, obviously, the whole idea is if you've got a good FLT3 inhibitor, and if midostaurin worked as a so-so FLT3 inhibitor, let's use a good FLT3 inhibitor from the beginning. So the lady could have gotten this, in other words. This guy showed up when we had a slot on this trial where he got 7 plus 3 plus gilteritinib. And so we're using it just like midostaurin, except these patients just stay on the drug, midostaurin induction, midostaurin maintenance, and midostaurin after transplant. And what's interesting, the cure rates that we are seeing, or I should say not cure. I don't like to use the word cure, but everybody's alive. Years out, we're really pretty favorable. We put 10 patients on this study at Hopkins. 9 of them are pretty far out from transplant, alive and disease-free, which is pretty extraordinary for a disease that when I entered the field 20 years ago had the opposite. It was about 10% alive and disease-free, you know, long-term.
So it sounds like these patients are very, very similar in terms of the path that they took.
Yeah, but this one, he's on the gilteritinib. He doesn't have to take the smelly pill. And obviously, we're trying to, there'll be a trial opening up worldwide comparing midostaurin versus gilteritinib in this fashion.
Wow, that's interesting. So just to finish out on this, it's really amazing how much you can talk about AML nowadays, but can you just briefly contrast what we know about the available FLT3 inhibitors? I guess the main ones to be focused on at this point, midostaurin, gilteritinib, and quizartinib.
So midostaurin is not a very potent FLT3 inhibitor. You can't use it by itself. By tossing it in with chemo or maybe a transplant, it clearly augments that, but it's not where we need to be. Gilteritinib is perhaps the designer FLT3 inhibitor because it hits both types of mutations, is extremely well tolerated, and we're going to use it at all aspects. However, gilteritinib is still not as potent as you can get. And quizartinib, which is only hits the ITD, doesn't hit the TKD, is far and away more potent. And right now, we have nearly finished accrual of a very important trial, quizartinib versus placebo up front. Newly diagnosed patients with FLT3 ITD mutations, they get either induction chemo plus either placebo or quiz. They get to stay on that throughout, even after transplant. That trial is nearly done accruing. That drug is much more potent than anything we've seen before. And the remissions might be yet deeper because cases can slip through gilt because it's not quite potent enough. So we can still do better.
I like that quiz and gilt. I haven't heard
quiz and gilt. That's what we call
them. I haven't heard
that
one before.
Quiz and gilt.
So I guess the idea is when you get through this quiz trial, you're going to indirectly compare it to midostaurin?
Yeah. So that's what's going to confuse the world. That sucker's going to come out not compared to anything. Gilt and mito are going to be compared to each other. Okay. So maybe gilt wins that. Great. So now, which is better, quiz or gilt? I'm more inclined to think quiz, by virtue of being more potent, is the thing you want to use up front early, and you might consider gilt as a maintenance therapy.
That's interesting.
I think that's looking way down the line.
Huh.
Right now, we're pretty thrilled that we have all these choices coming out at us.
Any difference in gilt for maintenance, is that partly related to quality of life? Do you have less symptoms with gilt?
Oh, no, you don't get any symptoms from quiz either.
Okay, just think maybe
No, that won't do it. It's really more biologic differences in the drug. You could get a much more rapid response in the relapsed refractory patient with quiz. I've never seen anything work faster than quiz.
Huh.
Problem is, TKDs emerge very quickly as a resistance feature.
Wow, interesting. So again, we could continue on this, but let's just briefly touch base about IDH mutations and IDH inhibitors. Maybe to get into that, I asked you to pick out a patient who actually had a problem with treatment, and you picked out this 63-year-old man. So what happened there?
He's an interesting case. What was kind of funny about him is I was actually arguing to his primary oncologist, use azavenetoclax. And the oncologist did not want to, thought it was too risky, and in fact, read about the tumor lysis and said, that's too dangerous.
Wow.
Okay. So it gave him AZA, and he didn't respond. The blast stayed absolutely unchanged. By then, I'd evaluated him and said, you know, he's got an IDH2 mutation. If he's really scared, we've got an approved treatment for him. He's now technically refractory, although his blasts were always kind of in the 15 to 20% range, technically sort of off-label because it was high-grade MDS. We just gave him that, but I said, on the other hand, now I've got to manage this because this is something you haven't seen before. I'm going to have to at least teach you about this. This is real differentiation syndrome. It's not as scary as APL, where they're busy trying to die on you in the inpatient setting, but you have to be prepared for it. And I told him, okay, we're going to watch you like a hawk. Blood counts twice, two, three times a week. And we're just going to wait and see what happens. Because I think it's actually more common than people realize or than the label stated. And I think the FDA is presenting some data that says, here, we've really characterized this phenomenon, differentiation. So we gave him the pill. And I remember when I knew something was going on, he came in and said, this is like 3 weeks later, I feel funny. Something's wrong. I don't feel right. And sure enough, his white count had gone up to 20K and his creatinine had bumped to 2, but we were more or less ready for it. It happened reasonably quick. We quickly started steroids, even though he was diabetic, made it a bit of an annoyance, got him on some Hydrea and kept the therapy going. Really, it was just 2 weeks or so of funny counts. It was pretty easy to manage if you know what you're looking for and are ready for it. It was still all outpatient.
So it looked like this patient had a great response.
Yeah, no, that was actually very impressive. He flew into remission, and it was actually, I think, what you call a CRH, because I think his platelets still never got above 100, but his marrow looked normal. We went ahead and transplanted him. And at this point now, I'm starting enasidenib as maintenance therapy. And that's kind of our new exploration too. It's like this was the driver mutation for his leukemia. He's transplanted. Maybe everything's fine. But in fact, why not do enasidenib as maintenance? And we're starting that as a clinical trial.
Do you factor into these maintenance decisions? I know you've written a lot about MRD.
With FLT3, we are going to be able to factor that in soon. All the randomized trials have MRD, measurable residual disease, as a marker, and it goes deep. You know, you're talking one cell in a million, one cell in 100,000. We can pick out, oh, you've got the ITD. The ITD mutation is unique. Each patient's got a different length. That's 33 base pairs. That's 21 base pairs. That's a signature for the patient. Not so with the IDH2 mutations. Those are point mutations. They're not terribly reliable as MRD measurements. So unfortunately, I have no doubt in 5 years from now, we're going to be moving into doing that. Right now, we're not in a position. I'm kind of just making the call, gee, maybe maintenance would help here.
So I see that you treated this patient with a differentiation syndrome with hydroxyurea and prednisone. What happened? Everything went away?
Everything went away. It's like, okay, that was easy. Creatinine came down. Creatinine stayed at 2 for a week and then came back down to the normal range. Literally 3 weeks later, all of his counts were normal and he was in remission.
Can you provide a little bit of an overview? There are now 2 approved agents, one for IDH1, IDH2. It kind of sounds like almost the same clinical story for both of them.
They're virtually identical.
Can you just sort of go through a primer about IDH mutations and IDH inhibitors and where we are today in terms of utilizing them? Kind of reminds me when we were talking about, you know, hypomethylating agents, venetoclax, that may be potentially very, very effective. But also, you know, you have this little thing here with the differentiation syndrome that you need to be aware of.
So, I mean, IDH mutations are actually pretty common, relatively speaking. They're a big chunk of AML. Interestingly, it was an IDH1 mutation, and it was first discovered in brain tumors. Glioblastoma, that nasty old GBM thing. The problem was you couldn't get the inhibitors. Oh, and then, okay, so great, you've got a mutation in this thing called IDH. What is IDH? Isocitrate dehydrogenase. That's a thing in the Krebs cycle. Are we inhibiting the Krebs cycle? No, we're not. There's 3 different enzymes with that name, IDH1, IDH2, IDH3. 3 is the Krebs cycle enzyme, so we're not going to screw up the Krebs cycle by inhibiting IDH. One is a pretty important enzyme out in the cytoplasm. It makes cofactors for enzymes. It makes this thing called alpha-ketoglutarate. That's its job. It is one of the byproducts of the Krebs cycle, but out in the cytoplasm, a lot of enzymes that are regulating DNA use that as a cofactor. So it's great fun if you're a cancer cell. If you cause this, and the mutation has to be present in a heterozygous form. It turns out a cell can't live with both knocked out. If you make it one mutant, one wild type, the resultant alpha-ketoglutarate comes out. Nope, we didn't quite make it to alpha-ketoglutarate. We made 2-hydroxyglutarate, a partial agonist. It screws up all those enzymes and screws up your DNA, at which point you can't differentiate anymore. But it's quite remarkable how rapidly cells will start differentiating. And in fact, if you throw this drug into leukemia cells with that mutation in a dish, they start growing. They actually, part of the process of suddenly having enough cofactor is they start dividing. And we see this in patients. White count rises. Marrow gets more proliferative. It's all part of the biology. And then they're going down the differentiation pathway. So in fact, if you were to put a patient on an IDH1 or an IDH2 inhibitor who's got a bone marrow packed full of leukemia or maybe 50% leukemia, don't look in the marrow 2 weeks later. You may see more cells. The pathologist might freak out and say, what's going on? No, what's going on is exactly what's supposed to happen. There's a proliferative phase, a differentiation phase, and then everything kind of returns to normal. It takes several cell cycles to do this. So it's actually really quite fascinating how the biology has all been worked out. And it's very different than conventional cytotoxic, just kill everything chemotherapy. So IDH1, IDH2, kind of treat them the same. You got to know which one you have. It's a very specific mutation. They're very unique. R140Q or R172, they're at arginines, or in the IDH1 and R132, they have to be the specific mutation. And then they can respond. You pick the IDH1 or IDH2 inhibitor.
So at this point, these two agents are just approved, correct me if I'm wrong, with relapse disease.
Yeah, but we saw those patients, particularly the IDH1s alone, they would be refractory to chemo. And so, of course, the trials have already been done combining 7+3 plus these inhibitors. It's safe to do. I'm not sure where that stands from an approval standpoint. I think we're still a little early to just tell everybody, if you see it, throw the drug in. I'm not doing that yet. We're still using it just in the relapse refractory setting.
One thing I was wondering, Rebecca, is I've heard stories like this one about patients with IDH mutations who got great responses. And I guess I'd think a little bit about the older patient, a patient who can't get chemo, maybe somebody who not even have a problem with a hypomethylating agent. Is there ever a role for these agents up front in a patient?
Oh, absolutely. So that trial is ongoing right now at our institution, newly diagnosed older patients with MDS, high grade, the same sort of disease we're talking about. This guy, just go straight for your IDH inhibitor and see how that works. And yeah, that's a lot kinder and gentler.
So one more thing before we get back over to ALL, you were mentioning MDS and kind of triggered my thought about the agent CPX-351.
Yeah.
Can you just sort of briefly give me your take on that? It's kind of an interesting story about how it kind of evolved and more really where it is right now.
Yeah, it is. We were initially very enthusiastic. It's a funny purple drug. It's, you know, liposomal 7 and 3. It's, you know, a first, we thought it was kinder and gentler 7 and 3. So the idea is you take cytarabine and daunorubicin and put them at the exact proportion you want in a liposome. Really, what it turns out, the liposome more directly delivers that to the bone marrow. So it isn't so much that it is less toxic. It is a little bit better targeted chemotherapy. It is nailing the bone marrow, but it's still pretty toxic. And the indication that they have for it in this so-called secondary AML, treatment-related AML, honestly, a bigger issue now in the field is the azacitidine thing. We're kind of pulling that out in favor of liposomal Ara-C daunorubicin. We just call it, well, the purple drug. And it, again, we were initially enthusiastic, and I believe there are definitely patients that I've had that have benefited, in fact, are alive today because they got a good response and I transplanted them and so forth. But I think it will be more interesting to see how that drug fares in comparison to azacitidine, because it's just so much easier to take a 75-year-old with secondary AML and give them azacitidine than liposomal Ara-C daunorubicin. So We're glad to have it. I think it needs to be explored more, particularly in younger patients. If you're going to use intensive therapy, it is Aricidonorubicin. It's just more intelligently designed. Patients don't lose their hair, for example. It's kind of cool. So again, yes, it definitely myelosuppresses, but it is a lot. It is easier to manage than garden variety 7+3.
So let's spend the rest of our time talking about ALL, and you have a couple cases here. One, this 28-year-old man. What happened there?
For years, we felt inferior to the pediatricians. They would always scold us and say, "You don't know how to treat ALL. You know, we cure everybody, and you guys are curing nobody." And we're looking at our patients. By the time you're age 30 in this country, a lot of patients have developed a number of medical comorbidities. They've got hypertension, they've got obesity, and so forth. This guy showed up, and yes, he was obese. And it turns out the best way to cure ALL with a pediatric regimen incorporates L-asparaginase. L-asparaginase is toxic as all get out to somebody like this. And sure enough, he turned yellow and swelled up and tried to die. Not to mention the fact that his leukemia, again, different from the pediatric world, was genetically worse. This guy had MLL rearranged acute leukemia.
Could I just clarify, though, you said he had problems with the asparaginase.
Yeah.
Was there any evidence of any kind of liver dysfunction before treatment?
No, but they have a fatty liver.
How obese was he?
Oh, he was pretty obese. He had a BMI of 35 or something ridiculous.
Really? Did you modify the dose of asparaginase?
We did. We modified some of his chemotherapy. This has been a controversy in the field is how you dose modify for the obese patient. We actually did not modify the L-asparaginase. We only slightly modified his vincristine. Again, what we have found from decades past is we probably have been under-treating these patients by dose reducing them or using some sort of ideal body weight. We were wildly underdosing. All we did with this guy was make him so sick. His bilirubin was 17. He was bedbound.
Wow.
And by the way, his leukemia was waving merrily at us from his blood. I mean, we hadn't touched it.
Wow.
So we thought things were bleak. Now, he has a bad leukemia. He's got its MLL rearranged. Again, this is worse risk. Not so uncommon in the grown-ups. And bad protoplasm. So there we're left with this poor guy, you know, about 6 or 8 weeks into his therapy. We've tried to hit him with a pediatric-inspired regimen. And he's now bedbound, jaundiced, with refractory leukemia.
So just to clarify, they say age is just a number, and usually you're talking about, you know, 70s and 80s. But here, age is another interesting number, because I hear, like, up to 40. This patient was 28. I know there are other issues. This man was obese. But how do you look at age and try to decide what to do?
So the up to age 40 thing, oh, yes, we all want to try and use a pediatric regimen in the patients up to age 40. As somebody who's been doing this for years, that really is very hard to do. Every now and then I pull it off, but it is just extraordinarily difficult to get these patients through. And if they have any comorbidities, you can kind of forget it. So we always tend to scale down. Nonetheless, my preference is to use what I call a BFM. That's the Berlin-Frankfurt-Munster regimen. It's a pediatric inspired. It's got L-asparaginase. It's got the usual drugs. I try to use that always.
So I imagine it must have been a terrible feeling to see him so sick with the bilirubin of 17, his leukemia.
Yeah, we had not helped him with our treatment. We made him worse off.
So what did you do at that point?
So then we pull out Blina, as we call it, blinatumomab. These are CAR T cells off the shelf because they work the same way. They basically, a CAR T cell, we take the T cell out of the patient, we genetically modify it and inject it back in. But it really, we genetically modify it to attack CD19. Okay, well, blinatumomab is a designer protein that links T cells with CD19. It's CD3 plus CD19 antigen binding regions in this funny little drug that unfortunately has a very short half-life. So you got to give it by continuous infusion. That's inconvenient, but convenient, because unfortunately, as it turns out, when you activate that many T cells all at once, you get these terrifying cytokine release syndromes. You make a T cell swim up to a leukemia cell and eat it, at which point it elaborates cytokines, at which point the patient gets a temperature of 105 and a blood pressure of 70 over palp and is completely delirious. With blinatumomab, you can just turn the infusion off and let things cool off. So in fact, in retrospect, it's actually not so terrible that it's continuous infusion. The drug goes away quickly, calm things down, resume it again couple of days later.
That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that perspective because it is like 28 days, right?
Yeah, it's 28 days. It's a bit of a pain. I just did that with a guy. He worked through the whole time. He grumbled, but, you know, he had this little pack around that he has to carry around. But this kid actually did not have, I'm not sure, maybe his T cells were jaundiced and they didn't, I don't know. But he didn't really get much of a cytokine release syndrome. And he said, that was easy. Why didn't you give me that thing from the beginning? You know, he flew into remission. He's like, well, we're sorry. It's kind of expensive and it's not approved up front. At which point then I just quickly transplanted him and he's totally fine. He's probably cured. He's a couple years out now. So, you know, yes, we have a lot of cases like that. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it must be. You mentioned you just saw him. That must be very gratifying when he walks through the door, huh?
Yeah, he's busy grumbling about like his work and this and that. And it's like, we're busy talking about how's the cat and whatever. It's like, we're not going to have leukemia here. Those are what I call the well child visits. You know, all the oncologists love those. Well baby visits.
So you talked about cytokine release with blinatumomab. The other thing that's been seen with CAR T is neurologic toxicity. You see that with blinatumomab?
Yeah, I tell my patients, okay, you might hear voices or you might have stuttering. And in fact, I have one patient, she's kind of fascinating. No one would treat her because she'd had a liver transplant and now she has ALL. I pretended to give her a little chemotherapy and said she was refractory and then started the blina. Flies into remission, but the neurologic side effect was stuttering.
Wow.
She stuttered during, you know, it was very distinct.
Wow.
And so then we let her go for a year. She's in remission. I gave her two cycles. She's in remission. She comes back. Okay, it's relapsing again. And she wants to go to Hawaii. I want to go to Hawaii with my family. So I said, okay, we'll give you 2 weeks of blina. And we packed 2 weeks in, stuttered the whole 2 weeks.
Wow.
Once we stopped it, the stuttering stopped. She goes off to Hawaii. She's in remission. But that was only 2 weeks. She relapsed about 6 months later. And the third cycle of blina has put her back in remission. The stuttering has not gone away.
Wow.
Now, the stuttering is mild. It's not terrible, but she says she definitely notices it. What causes that? We have no idea.
I mean, I've heard about aphasia or some kind of aphasia thing.
Yeah, so they'll get that a lot. One woman just like, she's not talking. She's not talking. Oh, give Decadron. We gave Decadron. She started talking again. Okay.
Wow. This woman was stuttering. You think it's the same kind of path?
I gather. It seems quite unpredictable.
Wow.
There were some auditory hallucinations. I've seen that.
Have you seen stuttering in other patients?
Yeah.
Really?
Stuttering is actually one of the more common things.
Stuttering. Wow. Do you know of any other drugs in medicine that cause stuttering?
Nope.
Wow. I wrote down here hearing voices because nobody ever said that to me before.
Oh, I definitely had that, yes.
Auditory hallucination.
The last guy I told about this, he's a functioning professional. I said, brace yourself. I don't know what's going to happen. And nothing neurologic happened, but his liver function enzymes went shot up through the roof. Whoa, we slowed down. And then after doing a lower dose and giving a little more time, everything normalized. I mean, it always seems to be something unpredictable, manageable, reversible, with the exception of what's interesting, this first case is stuttering, but I've never used blinatumomab like that multiple times. I mean, this patient literally can't even tolerate Hydrea, is not going to tolerate anything except blina, and so I don't really have a lot of options here.
Can you talk a little bit about exactly where blinatumomab is being used nowadays? One of the things I found really interesting is the idea of MRD positivity.
The clinical trial is a nationwide clinical trial enrolling about 400 patients, and it's actually about 3/4 done, where we had a lot of patients on this. You put them through standard ALL treatment, and when they get to about their fourth month, you do a bone marrow biopsy and you look for measurable residual disease at a low level. The general idea of the trial was, okay, patients with measurable residual disease will be randomized to get blina or not. The problem was the wheel sort of fell off the trial because by then everybody had figured out that this drug was really good. And we were taking patients off the study if they had MRD and giving them the drug because we were so convinced it was working. So we derailed our own trial. In fact, the patient that just had the liver enzymes go up, I did it purely for MRD. We did a bone marrow biopsy at 5 years, and this was Philly positive disease when I was going to take him off his TKI. Great news, we detected MRD. In fact, the thing is still sitting there staring at us very clearly. So he got blina as an MRD scrubber, as we say. We're going to scrub the MRD clean. So I gave him a cycle of blina. Now the MRD is undetectable. I gave him one more for good measure, and now we will unfortunately follow him with yearly bone marrow biopsies looking for MRD.
So I want to hear about your patient who got the CAR-T, but you mentioned Philly positive, and I really like your abbreviations. I think that could go a long way in oncology. But can you talk about how you manage Philadelphia positive disease and what we know about various TKIs in that situation?
First of all, I'll say ALL in the adult world, our long-term survival is now 80%, which is phenomenal. We're no longer ashamed to be adult oncologists anymore in this field. For Philly positive disease, I actually don't use the so-called BFM, or I don't use anything with L-asparaginase. They don't work with TKIs. TKIs and L-asparaginase just keep them apart. And therefore, we use the MD Anderson-inspired hyper-CVAD regimen, which is very well known, I think, you know, pretty much all around the world. What's interesting is that we're now doing an abbreviated hyper-CVAD. MD Anderson likes to call it mini hyper-CVAD, but actually the one we're using is not an MD Anderson one. It's a regimen out of France. Patients literally just get steroids and vincristine and a TKI, and the remission rate is just as high. But they're sitting reading a book the whole time during their month of induction. In fact, they can go home frequently. It's very easy. So we give them an abbreviated induction course, steroids, vincristine, TKI. I'll get into which TKI in a minute. We give them one intensive round of hyper-CVAD with the TKI, and then we usually transplant them. As to the choice of TKI, I will be honest, I tend to use dasatinib much more than anything else. Imatinib, the original TKI that everybody loves, the problem is patients don't tolerate it that well. It causes a lot of GI side effects, and it inhibits the receptor c-KIT. And inhibiting c-KIT means you get myelosuppression. So if you try and use this drug after chemo, they have problem recovering counts. So it's not well designed, in my view, for Philly-positive ALL. Nilotinib or dasatinib work well. And for one, I was using nilotinib for a while, and now I've swung back to dasatinib. Nilotinib still has some of the vague cardiovascular concerns. Is very well tolerated, and it works quite well. We kind of go back and forth with that. I tend to use this abbreviated hyper-CVAD of vincristine steroids plus dasatinib, and I leave the dasatinib on as much as possible.
What about ponatinib?
Ponatinib is a somewhat troublesome medicine. It is a very good drug, but at the higher doses, it will cause a lot of problems, pancreatitis, cardiovascular problems. And yet, it is the only thing that really hits the dreaded T315I mutation, and it probably, I think, has some CNS penetration. We're looking at using it up front at a lower dose, and it's now being used at much lower than the so-called approved doses. We're doing 15 and 30 milligrams. I'm very glad to have it, but I'm not so sure it should be used up front. Again, that's a matter for the future. It's used right now in the relapse setting when they're resistant to their current TKI. It's actually pretty effective, but really only in a relapse setting right now.
Any tolerability issues?
Yes. One of the things I've noticed with ponatinib is the patients get really dry skin, thick, hard, hide-like, certainly at 30 milligrams, less so at 15, but they definitely get a skin rash. I just had another one come in. I'd had her on only 15 milligrams, and she got yet another episode of pancreatitis. It's not life-threatening pancreatitis. It's my belly hurts and my amylase is up. Okay, well, I better do something. So now she's on 15 milligrams every other day. She's on ponatinib because she has a mutation that's the only thing that hits it. And by the way, so she's an interesting case. She relapsed with one of these mutations. I gave her salvage hyper-CVAD, but she still had residual disease. I then gave her blinatumomab. And again, the story was, why didn't you give that to me before? And this was 4 years ago.
Wow.
And then I've just kept her on ponatinib at these low doses since then. But this is somebody who relapsed after a transplant with Philly-positive ALL. Little Blina, and now she just won a ping pong championship in her state. I mean, 4 years later, she's fine. On ponatinib with kind of funny skin and occasional pancreatitis. And I'm still nervous because I don't think I've cured, but I have Blina in my back pocket to use again.
Fascinating. Let's finish out with your 41-year-old lady who got CAR-T therapy.
So she had, you know, so-called garden variety pre-BALL, got chemo, we transplanted her, and she relapsed. Okay, Now we've got this new toy, Blenna. We give Blenna, and she had active disease when you give Blenna. If you have a lot of disease when you give Blenna, you are usually asking for it. And we got the temperature of 104, 105, sick as a dog.
How long into the Blenna did that start?
12 hours.
Wow.
Yes. Brace yourselves. It's very fast. The first patient I gave Blenna to, and of course that happened, I had to leave for a meeting that day. And when I got back, she ripped into me. You hung that stuff and you left with my temperature of 105. I said, look, you're in remission. What are you yelling at me for? So this patient got the cytokine release syndrome. We got her through it and we got her to a second transplant. And of course, she relapsed again. And for this third try, we did the CAR T cells. And the CAR T cells, interestingly, we were braced for this terrifying cytokine release syndrome. Here we go. Nothing happened except the patient flew into remission. Oh, that was easy. We were so surprised because we thought it didn't work because there was no cytokine release syndrome. And the patient clearly had active disease when we infused the CAR T cells. But you look what the patient has to go through to get to that point. This patient truly died on us while we were waiting for the CAR T cells to grow. And that's the problem with the CAR T cells. So here she is. She's relapsed. This is her third relapse. She's a mess. So first, we're going to harvest the T cells, take them off to the lab and grow them up and get them all, you know, modified. That takes weeks. We got to keep her alive. She coded during that month.
Wow.
We had to give her cytoreductive chemotherapy. We're frantically trying to keep her alive. Her ejection fraction had fallen to 15%. We said, what are we doing here?
What was going on with her heart?
Oh, we'd hit her with so much chemo and it was just chemotherapy-induced cardiomyopathy.
Wow.
And she was really sick when we did the echo. You know, sick hearts always look worse. I mean, she actually, her ejection fraction is normalized. But we were terrified when we put those CAR T cells. This is the kiss of death. I mean, she's not going to survive this cytokine release syndrome. Well, she didn't get one. So then we thought it didn't work. So we looked in the marrow and said, oh my God, it worked. And in fact, she is alive and well and in remission with a, I don't know, maybe the CAR T cells fixed her heart. I'm not sure, but everything is kind of back to normal. You know, and she's more than a year out from that.
What preparation of CAR T did she receive? And what preparations are out there that are being looked at?
There's two, and there's a whole patent war that ensued. Good heavens. And there's one kind of sponsored out of the University of Penn and another one that was sponsored out of St. Jude's and Memorial. This one we did on a trial. The approved agent, I think, is the Tisaglenn-Leclucel product, which is technically derived from the University of Pennsylvania work. I think they're equally effective. The data that I've seen, they work, and you can get long-term survivals, apparently cures. There's a plateau to the survival curve with these patients.
Can you take a step back and talk a little bit about what we know about CAR T in ALL, how it's utilized currently, and where you think it's heading?
CAR T, I think, is kind of where bone marrow transplant was in the 80s. Terrifying, and we're not quite sure how to use it, but we think this is where the field is going to go, and every now and then it works really well. The simple truth is, I think this is a typical patient. They often don't get to CAR T cells. You know, she was lucky to, but in fact, frequently, these patients just are not stable enough, and so as a matter of practice, I'm using Blenna more than CAR T cells. But I chose this case to illustrate CAR T probably works better than Blenna if you can get it to work. And I think that the simple truth is it's extraordinarily expensive. You've got to have the tertiary care center and an infrastructure set up to use it. And even at our institution, that's cumbersome. So it's really in its nascency right now. I'm pretty confident that it is going to be the treatment of the future. But I think the future is still 5+ years away. Yes, it's great. But again, I think the best analogy is what bone marrow transplant used to be in the 80s. Oh my God, that's terrifying. You know, occasionally it works. So it just takes too much time. I think they're going to do a randomized trial of Blenna versus CAR T. And you really need to do the intention to treat. In other words, relapsed refractory ALL patient, okay, you're randomized to CAR T. How many actually make it to CAR T cell therapy and actually get it? That's going to be where the real issue is. If we can demonstrate a smooth path to, okay, step one, identify patient, step two, harvest T cells, step three, stabilize patient, keep them alive long enough to get the CAR T cell product. Gee, maybe we should give Blenna to keep them alive and then give them the CAR T. In addition, if you put CAR T cells in, they kill every B cell off in your body for the end of time, at which point you don't have any antibodies left, at which point your immune system is not all that great. I suspect we're going to end up using this as a bridge to transplant and putting in a whole new immune system after the CAR T cells. So the field is wildly evolving right now, with both making the technology smoother, faster, cheaper, better. And so we're going to see a lot of changes, but I'm not quite sure how it's all going to end up. But I think CAR T is here to stay, and I think they are effective.
Bridge to transplant. Are you thinking that CAR T would not be used up front?
Oh, they might well be. Again, the problem is you either have to engineer a suicide gene to get rid of these things, or it's tough to live life without a B cell. You know, your antibody levels drop to nothing and you're giving gamma globulin all the time. But if you put in a whole new immune system that reconstitutes, then you can get B and T cells from the donor. Or engineer a suicide gene into the T cells.
A suicide gene into the T cells.
Yeah, so they're looking at that as well.
You mentioned the concern about the delay in therapy, and there's been this term used. You actually use it related to blinatumomab, but also off-the-shelf CAR T.
Yeah.
Assuming the blinatumomab is not exactly identical to CAR T, you kind of seems like you have this feeling that maybe CAR T is more effective. Do you see the way towards off-the-shelf CAR T?
No, not yet. You've got to be able to, you know, it's the patient's T cells. Unless you can find a way to design a T cell that doesn't randomly attack everything, which is random donor T cell, you have to use the patient's T cells. So I don't really see a way around that yet.
You also mentioned the issue of the B cell aplasia that's seen, the need for gamma globulin. If you do that, you do administer gamma globulin, do these patients continue to have problems, or does that pretty well solve the problem?
So I think we're learning about that going forward. I mean, I certainly had a patient who had had a transplant, and therefore his T cell immunity wasn't terribly normal. Then he got treated with CAR T, and now he's lost all his B cells, and he actually died of a garden variety viral infection. Poor man just didn't have any immune system. It was, you know, severe combined. So no, this is something we're going to learn about going forward. It's not like we have huge numbers of these patients yet. That's the other kind of interesting thing is, like, even, you know, only the couple centers that develop them can say they have dozens of these patients. We're not talking hundreds or even thousands of these patients. It's dozens. So we're still learning about this.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about is gemtuzumab, and also wanted to ask you about inotuzumab for...
Yeah, that's INO.
Right, INO. Yeah, I'm liking that whole thing.
Yeah.
But can you talk about these two antibody drug conjugates and how they fit into therapy?
So the problem with antibody drug conjugates is the drug that's conjugated doesn't stay conjugated terribly long, and it leaches out and poisons the rest of the body. So you tend to take these patients to transplant if you're using these drugs, and then they die during transplant or they're at high risk. So that still is sort of a black mark against both antibody drug conjugates. That said, they do have their uses. Gemtuzumab, the older drug that we always use, is anti-CD33 conjugated to a vicious thing called calicheamycin, does work in certain circumstances. We've always known about it. It's like, it occasionally will salvage a relapse patient. It was interesting, though, that in Europe, when they began really studying this, that the cooperative group trials there clearly demonstrated that if you had favorable risk AML, meaning core binding factor, inversion 16821, here's another example of subtype your AML, if they even got one dose of gemtuzumab in their induction regimen, their survival was dramatically better than the others. So many, if not most, AML centers in the U.S. are incorporating gemtuzumab in their early treatment, the so-called favorable risk AMLs. Now, we don't use it in anybody else because many of those other patients end up going to bone marrow transplant, and this is not a drug you want to give before a bone marrow transplant. You just don't want to do that. So it's very specialized use, but we're glad we have it. We're trying to look at its use for APL because we think it actually is going to be pretty effective to debulk APL, but that's a story in progress. INO is a little bit different. INO is still finding its way. It is an antibody drug conjugate against CD22. It is effective. I have used it to salvage ALL patients, but I have also seen those ALL patients die from transplant-related complications due to VOD. VOD is the dreaded condition called veno-occlusive disease. I like to describe it as you've had too much chemo and your body is melting. And that's essentially what happens to patients who get this type of drug and get a transplant. And so we're still learning when and how to incorporate iNO into either salvage or upfront treatment of ALL. That's an evolving story, and Blina, in my view, overshadows it considerably.
So just to finish out on that, I did want to ask you about management of high-risk APL, because I had heard that gemtuzumab was something that is considered, and then you just mentioned it's being looked at upfront.
That was a debate at our leukemia group, and the debate is ongoing. We want to try and use this. We don't like using chemotherapy for an APL patient if we don't have to. Mind you, gemtuzumab has got a DNA-damaging agent, calicheamycin, so it is chemo, but it's a lot kinder and gentler than the chemo we've been giving. And there are trials that clearly illustrate it can work. They just aren't large trials. So we haven't yet taken the leap to use gemtuzumab in high-risk APL, but I think we're about to. On the other hand, as far as I know, nobody that I'm aware of is using it in high risk. We're actually, I think, on the cusp of doing it. So I think it's going to happen. Somebody's got to swallow hard and do it. I'm insisting that we do it as part of a protocol. I want to at least tally the results. So I think we're going to write a protocol and just start doing it. I think we can do it and get insurance to pay for it. I think it will be good for patients, but I want to be able to tally the results carefully, watch for complications, and report the results to the world.
Maybe I misunderstood it. I thought it was being used with high risk with chemo.
There are some protocols that fold it in as well, yes. In fact, really no. The main drugs that we're folding in with chemo is arsenic and ATRA.
So you're talking about replacing the chemo with the gemtuzumab.
Correct. We want to get the chemo all gone. We don't want to give the anthracyclines at all. So we're trying to sort out, do we have the nerve to treat somebody with high risk with gemtuzumab, ATRA, and arsenic? And I think we do have the nerve. We're just going to do it on a protocol.